It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. My guest today has just finished one of the most extraordinary canoe journeys I have ever heard of. He paddled the Inside Passage, portaged the Chilkoot Pass, floated down the Yukon, and much more, ending up in Anchorage, all in 5 months. Bob Volhaber is in the studio. You may have seen his picture in the newspaper. That's where I found out about his amazing accomplishment and asked him to come in into the studio to talk to us. We're recording today as he has just finished his trip in mid-September and before he leaves town and goes back to his regular life, because we wanted the opportunity to capture the first impressions of one of the truly great Alaska adventures. And Bob, congratulations and thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
It must seem kind of unreal after 5 months, almost completely by yourself, completely in the wilderness, to suddenly be at Anchorage on the radio. You're ready to get on a plane and go back to Minnesota.
Yeah, it's a culture shock to be back in the city again. Yeah, actually, when I was approaching the city here on Sunday afternoon, I was probably 5 miles away, and all the planes started coming, you know, into the landing area, and just all the noise was really a shock to me. I just haven't been used to that kind of activity before for almost 6 months.
Yeah. So we're talking on Tuesday. You got back on Sunday, 48 hours basically since you paddled up, it sounds like, to the Coastal Trail. Just showed up on the Anchorage Coastal Trail in your canoe after starting out in Tacoma, Washington.
Yep, that's correct.
All right, so let's trace this, because as soon as people hear what you did, they're just going to be glued to the radio. So you started out in Tacoma on March 24th.
Actually, it was in Orcas Island.
Oh, okay, Orcas Island, beautiful. Yeah.
Yep.
And you paddled all the way up the Inside Passage to Skagway. And how long did that leg take you? Like a month or
that
two?
That took me 42 days.
That's you were paddling really fast.
Yeah, it might be the fastest on record. I haven't heard of anybody doing it that fast. But
yeah.
I was pushing hard because I wanted to get here when the ice broke on the Yukon River.
Yeah. So then you went to Skagway, waited a little while due to weather, and then were the first one over the Chilkoot Pass in the spring carrying your canoe, your rigid canoe, and all your gear. You went over the Chilkoot Pass.
Yep, that's correct.
It's just unbelievable. And the pictures on your, I mean, I was saying before the show, I told a couple of people about this, and I keep getting, no, he didn't do that. That's not possible. But there's pictures there of him with this canoe going over the Chilkoot Pass. So then you paddle down the route of the Klondike Stampeders across Lake Bennett and down the upper Yukon to Dawson City.
Yep, and I continue on down to about Fort Yukon, where the Chandler River comes into the Yukon.
Right, that's like, make it sound easy, but that's like another 900 miles.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was easy.
Right, easier than what you've done up to then,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And then you paddled up the Chandler River because you're trying to get back to your old cabin.
Correct. Yeah, I had built a cabin on the Koyukuk River about 24 years ago. So as part of this trip, I wanted to get back to the South Fork of the Koyukuk. So
Chandler is a pretty fast flowing whitewater river, isn't it?
Yeah, as all the natives there told me, they call it a swift river. Mm-hmm. They told me it was impossible to make it up there, especially with the flood conditions.
And how many miles? On the Chandler?
150 miles up the river.
So then you got to your cabin, and then you portaged across tundra to get to the Koyukuk, right?
Well, I had a portage before I got to my cabin. I had a portage from, I went up the Chandler, took the West Fork until it became a trickle of water, and from there I portaged all my stuff across the tundra and the bush. There's no established trail there, of course. It's just wilderness. So
bushwhacking with carrying a rigid canoe.
Yep.
Okay, just make sure we got that clear. Right.
Yep. Then I got into the South Fork of the Koyukuk.
And how many miles were those two portages?
That was about 15 miles cross-country to get to the South Fork of the Koyukuk.
And then you were floating down the Koyukuk?
Down the Koyukuk, stopped at my cabin site, and then which is not too far from the Dalton Highway.
Uh-huh. And then rejoining the Yukon?
Yep, down the Yukon River to the Bering Sea.
Which is another huge amount of mileage, but at least you're not paddling against the stream.
right.
Yeah. And then the Bering Sea, I mean, paddling the shore of the Bering Sea is maybe the craziest thing out of this whole story, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I hadn't heard of anybody. I couldn't find anybody that's ever paddled south from the mouth of the Yukon down the Bering Sea coastline, and I see why now. But
We'll talk about that. So then you paddled down to the Kwijak River.
Kwijak, yeah.
And then paddled up the Kwijak.
Up to Lake Iliamna.
That's, again, pretty fast flowing river.
Fairly fast, yeah.
Yeah. And then Lake Iliamna, can you paddle right into the lake from the river?
Yes, you can.
Okay. And then it's 90 miles across Lake Iliamna.
Yeah. Yep.
Long way. Okay. And then you got another huge portage.
I crossed at the Williamsport Road. And that time was, I actually used truck assistance to get across. I cheated on that one. So okay. I feel bad about it, but we can talk about that later.
There was a little small asterisk. Yeah. I think we're willing to give you a tiny bit of credit on that one. And then you relaunched back into, you have crossed the Alaska Peninsula, you relaunched back into, are you in Shelikof Strait there or are you in Cook Inlet at that point?
I'm in Cook Inlet.
Mm-hmm. And that's a dangerous wild body of water to be canoeing in as well.
Yeah, as I found out, I was hoping it would be an easy coast to Anchorage, but not so.
So then you canoed basically the length of Cook Inlet, crossed over to Anchorage, and showed up on the coastal trail and said, hi, I've made it.
Yep, that's right.
Well, it's an amazing, amazing journey, and we're going to be talking about it for over the next hour here on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth, and my guest is Bob Volhaber, who is just done this canoe journey starting from Orcas Island, Washington, going all the way through the interior, touching the Arctic and then the Bering Sea, crossing the Alaska Peninsula and coming back to Anchorage. Now, Bob, a lot of times when people do big journeys, we hear about them because they start out telling everybody that they're going to do it, getting sponsorships, raising money. Maybe they do some kind of charity thing. Then they go along and they, and this goes all the way back to some of the North Pole explorers who all were, as soon as they got back, they were looking to get coverage and write a book and make money. But it sounds like it was just a personal journey for you.
It was. I was 180 degrees opposite from what you just described. I didn't want it to get out. I knew it would eventually, but I kept it quiet in Minnesota. Only my family and my employer knew that I was going to be doing it until about a month beforehand.
And what was your reasoning for that?
It's just a personal journey, just my own thing. I didn't want outside influences. I didn't want sponsorships. People did approach me or companies approached me, but I refused it. I just wanted to do my own thing. It was for myself.
Uh-huh. And did you feel like sort of keeping it quiet was one way of just keeping it belonging to you? And I also wonder, keeping anybody from trying to talk you out of it?
It was just to keep it to myself. And I didn't want any outside pressures. And to tell you the truth, I was paddling areas that I wasn't familiar with. Oceans and currents and strong rivers. So maybe part of me didn't know if it was really possible to do it.
You didn't want to say you're going to do it.
I didn't want to talk big and then fail. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So, and I mean, some of what you did was extremely dangerous. Did anybody try to talk you out of it? Family members or anything?
Everybody. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And actually a lot of Alaskans were the most critical of the trip. I had posted online a question about the Bering Sea and that started a big discussion up here.
Uh-huh.
And many of the Alaskans here that have experience with the areas tried their best to turn me around and tell me to do something easier.
Well, that's what I would do. I would say, no, you can't do this in 5 months. It's not possible.
Yeah, some said it was a 3-year trip.
Mm-hmm. So what kept you, what gave you the idea that you could do it?
Just
wanted to find out?
Yeah, just knowing my skill level. I grew up in the outdoors, and I knew I was capable of doing quite a few things here. And it's just a matter of, could I make the daily mileage that it took to do it in 1 year?
Uh-huh.
And would my body hold out against all those rigors? And so...
Yeah, yeah. So what is your previous, have you done any massive wilderness treks before?
Yeah, the previous biggest one was when I was in college, I came out to Alaska. To live off the land and run a trap line. I did that up in the Brooks Range near Coldfoot. Mm-hmm. So I built a cabin up there, and that was probably the biggest wilderness experience I've had. But I've done some decent sized canoe trips in Minnesota too. 2 years ago, I did a 300 mile canoe trip on my own in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really after I completed that, that was pretty much what got me thinking about doing something longer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I dreamed of this one.
Yeah, and then do you mind if I ask your age?
I'm 46.
Okay, so you're good to get it done now, huh?
I still feel like a kid.
All right, great. So tell me about your equipment. The canoe, it looks almost like a kayak in the pictures. What's the story about behind this canoe?
It's called a partially decked canoe. It's an expedition class canoe built by Verlin Kruger is a designer. He was a big canoeer. He did over 100,000 miles in his lifetime. Mm-hmm. And he developed this design for big water. Mm-hmm. So when I did some research, I was going to first try it in a regular open canoe. And I got some advice that that wasn't a good idea because of the heavy winds and big waves on the ocean, of course.
Yeah.
So when I found this canoe, it was the perfect fit. Heavy for the portages, but very seaworthy.
Looks like it's fiberglass?
It's Kevlar and fiberglass.
Mm-hmm.
13 layers on the hull, so it's really built strong.
Yeah. And then a spray skirt as well.
Yes, similar to like a kayak, only the opening in this canoe is 7 feet long, so it's a big opening compared to like a kayak. Mm-hmm.
And it's bigger than a kayak.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And you're seated basically in the middle of the canoe?
In the middle, yep.
So with you're not using a double paddle like on a kayak?
I used a canoe paddle 95% of the time. I did bring a spare paddle, which was a double blade, a kayak paddle.
Mm-hmm.
I brought that for shallow water and fast currents.
Mm-hmm. But you ended up using the canoe paddle most of the time. And what's your reason for that choice?
The canoe paddle, it wasn't maybe quite as fast as a double blade, but over a long haul or a long day, I think I could probably do more with a single blade. Because as you're paddling on, you can switch sides and rest half of your muscles in between. So you're able to go a long distance. So it was really the duration of how long you could paddle hard with that single blade.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a practice with this equipment before you started out back in Minnesota?
A little bit. I dreamed up the trip only a year ago. So it was a frantic search for the right equipment for something of this magnitude.
Uh-huh.
And it took a couple months to have the canoe built. But then, I put in about 600 miles last year in Minnesota. Mm-hmm.
Sounds like you're pretty happy with the equipment, with the canoe at least. Any stuff that you made mistakes on equipment-wise?
I wasn't going to bring any electronic equipment whatsoever originally, but my dad wanted me to bring a telephone and this and that. And so
telephone doesn't work out there, or is it satellite?
A sat phone would have worked, but I didn't want any electronics. But I did compromise. It made sense that he wanted to be able to track me, make sure I was still alive. So I was looking at a spot device, and then I found something that's called InReach by DeLorme. That's like a spot device, but it also allows two-way email communication if you pair it with their GPS.
Mm-hmm.
So I did bring that equipment, and unfortunately on day four, the two devices wouldn't communicate anymore. So I never had that two-way communication I was counting on.
Oh, wow.
So that was my only major gear failure. They both worked individually, but not together.
So your family could see where you were. They could go online and see where you were.
Family, and eventually when word got out, that I think there's thousands of people around the world that have been watching that tracking device.
Well, and we've got your blog posted on our website at alaskapublic.org, and there's some videos there which are really interesting and photos that are really interesting. And for anyone who's skeptical that this actually took place, all the evidence you need is on the blog. We're talking to Bob Volhaber, who has just completed 48 hours ago one of the most amazing canoe journeys ever in Alaska, starting in Washington, going through the Inside Passage, over the Chilkoot Trail, down the Yukon, up the Chandler, down the Koyukuk, across part of the Bering Sea, up the Kvijak, across Lake Iliamna, and then up Cook Inlet to Anchorage. I'm Charles Woolforth. The show is Outdoor Explorer. We're pre-recording. We got the chance to get Bob in the studio, and we decided we needed to take that opportunity to be the first to interview him about this incredible journey. So, and what do you do back in Minnesota? Are you took 6 months off? Are you headed back to work, or what's going on?
Yes, I am. I'm normally in the road construction business there.
Uh-huh.
So taking off this summer is pretty much taking off the whole year there. It's similar to Alaska. We have a brief time to build roads, and I wasn't there. So,
And you had to. This had to cost some money too, for not only equipment but resupply and all that.
Yeah, the equipment was the biggest expense, other than not having a salary for a year, but. You got to sacrifice some things.
Yeah. Did you just, you sound like you were eating a lot of freeze-dried food. Were you able to just buy it along the way?
No, before I'd left, I dehydrated a bunch of food 24 hours a day for about a month, making prepackaged meals for suppers and then vacuum sealing those.
Mm-hmm.
And your breakfast is consisted of pancakes or oatmeal or something like that I could boil up real quick and eat.
So were you able to carry like 5 months of food in your canoe?
No, I could carry up to about 2 months.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's a big canoe. There's a lot of room in there.
Uh-huh.
It has a capacity of 500 pounds, so I filled it up as best I could.
But that's your muscles moving that 500 yeah. pounds through the water. Like it Archimedes' principle, you're actually moving all that water,
it,
right?
It took a lot to get it moving every time, but
yeah.
once you get moving, it's not much different.
Right, right. So that momentum probably helps you in the waves and stuff.
It gives you stability. Yes,
uh-huh.
it does.
Uh-huh. So let's take it back to Shaw Island, launching on your way. Had you canoed in the ocean? Because you were facing some pretty big waves going up the
ocean. I had never been canoeing in the ocean before, so that was a whole new ball game for me. And the tides and everything associated with tides is all new to me, too. So it was a little bit of trepidation that I left Orcas Island.
I bet you learned some lessons on the way up the Inside Passage.
The first day when I left, I got into some really bad tidal conditions out there, and I quickly learned that I got to be careful with that.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't really know how to... read the tides and get and use the tide book and the current charts and all that?
Or? I didn't have that information with me, so
uh-huh.
the best I could do was look at what was coming for land features and try to guess which way the tides were coming.
Uh-huh.
I did have not a tide book, but on my GPS it would give me occasional locations of the high and low tides. So I did have some of that information for part of the trip, which helped.
So when you ran into waves or tidal conditions that were threatening, what would you just hole up on the beach, or would you just sort of try to work your way through it? Because, I mean, you made one of the things, it doesn't look like you spent much time holing up because you made amazing time. You really went fast.
The pre-planning, the idea was to run for shore and hide and wait things, let things go by and take a rest. But as it turned out, that never really much happened. I was too gung-ho to push it and push it hard. So I usually tried to go through whatever I encountered. There was a couple times with some bad wind conditions where I did have to head for shore on the Inside Passage. And there is a couple of pieces of coastline in the passage that are exposed to the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
The first one was Cape Cosh, and that one I got into some really big ocean swell.
Mm-hmm.
You want to go into?
Oh, you tell okay. you. How did you handle that? You just
I was approaching Cape Cosh in the evening, and I'd already done like 30 miles that day, so that's normally about a full day's paddle. But when I rounded the corner, I could see the Cape up there about 6 miles away, and I got motivated. And I said, "Okay, go for it." So I just paddled really hard, like I was in a canoe race, and away I went. And the ocean swell was about 2.5 meters, which is about 9 feet or so. And it was easy to handle those big rollers. They're nice, gentle rollers when they're...
It's like canoeing up and down hills,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but unfortunately, I was also approaching maximum ebb current. So I came past a big bay opening that when it was narrow, and all of a sudden, the current was coming out from that bay, hitting the swell, and I didn't realize that the current would really affect the swell.
Mm-hmm. Make it real steep and
it
sharp.
It did, yeah. Yep. So those 9-foot waves turned into, I'm guessing, 12 to 15-foot steep waves breaking.
Yeah.
So things quickly turned sour around me there, and I just, all I could do was paddle through them, and when I seen the one coming to break, I'd turn into it and hop over it and pretend like it was planned.
Wow.
Because you don't want to panic, and because when you start panicking, you kind of psychologically you're giving up. So
yeah,
you know, I'd hit a big one, I'd say, "Is that all you got?" And I'd wait for the next one.
And how long did you, I mean, that you have to fight your way through that for quite a while?
That was only about a half hour.
Uh-huh. A long half hour, I imagine.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Yep. Time goes slow when you're watching every wave come.
Uh-huh.
And I made it to the Cape then about 7:30 at night. I was all excited. I took some video and some pictures and kind of celebrated. Then I thought, okay, I got to go to shore and camp for the night. Only it's all rocky shoreline.
Yeah.
And with the swell, when the swell come by shore.
Really hard to land.
Yeah. So
yeah.
I couldn't get to shore, so I kept
paddling.
And this
is March we're talking about, or late March?
That would have been
April.
Early April.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So it's pretty cold out, I imagine.
It's pretty chilly. And, of course, there was a forecast for a major blow coming in that night. Heavy downpours, so I knew there was some bad weather coming, so I had to get off the water, and I couldn't, so I just kept paddling, and pretty soon it was after dark. My flashlight, I had taken the batteries from the flashlight earlier from my GPS or something, so now I didn't have a flashlight, and it was cloudy, so it was pitch black, so I was canoeing by sound for about 2 hours.
Wow. In still fairly rough weather.
fairly rough. Yeah. I got into a bay and I just hugged the coastline, listening for the waves, trying to figure out if there was a sand beach or somewhere where I could get on shore. I think it was about midnight, all of a sudden I finally ran into a dock, and boy, was I ever happy to hit that dock, because I knew that big, it was supposed to be 35 mile per hour winds coming, so I knew if I didn't get off the water, I was going to be in big trouble.
Wow. So we're talking with Bob Volhaber about his amazing canoe journey from Washington through the most of Alaska and to Anchorage. He just arrived 48 hours ago. We're pre-recording today's show. Today is September 17th when we're recording. There must have been times when you were in a situation like you're just discussing, canoeing in the dark, unable to see the shore, knowing a storm is coming, when you're thinking, this is a big mistake. What the heck am I doing out here?
I never had that thought, I guess.
Really?
No. The thought was more of just, I gotta get shelter somewhere. I gotta get off and get safe.
Just stay in the moment and don't.
Don't dwell on it. You're there. You gotta get yourself out of the situation. And eventually, I always did.
Mm-hmm. Did you learn enough lessons from those first couple of days on the Inside Passage to make it less eventfully up to Skagway, or did you have some more terrifying moments like that?
Well, it's a learning moment, but it also gave me more confidence. So,
yeah,
as I went further up, I tended to take more risk under higher wind conditions, just because I got more confidence. So, it helped me gain experience and knowledge, but it didn't make me slow down.
Yeah, well, it seems like the fact that you were prepared to just bowl your way through heavy waves in a canoe is why you were able to do this in the amount of time you did. Because most people would, I think, say, okay, it's windy, it's big waves, I'm in a canoe, I'm just going to wait till it dies down. But that would slow you down a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And the impetus was to get to Skagway so I could chase the ice down the Yukon River. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping for an early ice out up in Alaska here. So I pushed hard to get there. And when I got there, I found out that it was just the opposite. It was the second snowiest month on record in Skagway, and it was the coldest ever May in Skagway. So I got delayed there waiting for avalanche danger to go down a little bit in the Chilkoot.
Yeah, so Bob carried his canoe and all his gear over the Chilkoot Pass, and we're going to have a break here in just a minute. We're going to hear about that part of the adventure, which just sounds extraordinary. The show is Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. My guest is Bob Volhaber, who has just completed a 5,000-mile canoe journey through Alaska, starting in Washington, ending in Anchorage. We're pre-recording the show today because Bob has just gotten off the water, and we're the first to be able to download some of these stories from his extraordinary tale. But we're going to take a break now, and we'll be back in the second half to talk more with Bob. But right now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. Tonight at 6 p.m., REI Anchorage will host a free class on snowshoeing basics. This free class is best for moms, dads, and kids old enough to pay attention to a classroom-style talk and demonstration. For more info, go to rei.com/Anchorage. On Sunday, November 3rd, the Eagle River Nature Center will offer a free program on cross-country skiing pointers. Former college racer Marcella Dent will talk about metal-aged backcountry skis, classic and skate skis, followed by a hot wax demonstration. To sign up, go to ernc.org. Finally, the Winter Olympian Costume Fun Run is coming this Sunday at Alaska Pacific University. To tell us a little bit more about this 5K run or walk on APU trails, we have with us APU Nordic Ski Team coach, Kalisa Kastning. Hi, Kalisa.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So what is this event exactly?
Yeah, we thought it'd be fun to have a send-off for all our potential Winter Olympians that will be representing Alaska in Sochi in February of 2014. And so we thought it would be fun to have a 5K run on campus. In this run, you can expect an entertaining course with thigh-burning climbs, heart-racing challenges, and a single track that many of you probably didn't even know existed.
So, and folks will get to meet some of our, I guess they're still potential Olympians at this point.
Still potential Olympians.
But pretty darn likely to be there.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just skiers. There's other athletes vying for spots in sports, hockey, speed skating, border cross, Nordic skiing, biathlon, figure skating, and alpine skiing.
So Keegan Randall is an APU skier, and I know APU as a club has got an amazing number of skiers who could have a real good chance of making the Olympic team, right?
That's correct. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to put a number. I would say upwards of, you know, even, you know, 4 to 6 could make this Olympic team. 4 of the APU athletes are on the U.S. ski team. That's 40% of the U.S. ski team are APU skiers.
Amazing, amazing. So the it's a fun run. Is it timed?
It's an untimed fun run. There'll be finish cards at the finish chute, and there will be a clock so people can look up and see what time they finish. But with this exciting course, we don't expect anyone to have a personal record, a PR.
Yeah, well, I know APU workouts seem to be kind of crazy, so so it probably weaves all over the place. So costumes, what are you hoping for there?
Yeah, I think lots of fun costumes. Be creative. Obviously, our poster has the classic Superwoman costume, but yeah, definitely be creative and come out and have a good time.
And rain or shine or snow.
Absolutely.
All right. So give us the time, place, and any entry fee?
The time is 11 a.m. this Sunday, October 27th, at the APU campus. There's no fee, but the money raised will go to the National Nordic Foundation, which is our national organization that provides support for athlete development pipeline of U.S. Cross-country skiers and Nordic combined. And it will be split with the Alaska Winter Olympian Fund, which is a local scholarship fund offered through the Alaska Community Foundation. And this offers scholarships to both current and potential Winter Olympians, not just skiing, but in any Winter Olympic sport.
Fantastic. We'll have a link to the Winter Olympian Costume Fund Run, as well as links to all of the events mentioned on today's Outdoor Explorer calendar at alaskapublic.org. Stay with us for the second half of the show when we return to our interview with canoe adventurer Bob Volhaber, recorded September 17th, when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and I've got a really exciting show today talking to Bob Volhaber, who just finished a 5,000-mile canoe journey starting in Orcas Island, Washington, going up the entire Inside Passage to Skagway, over the Chilkoot Pass, down the Yukon River, up the Chandler River, portage to the Koyukuk, down the Koyukuk, back to the Yukon, to the Bering Sea, along the Bering Sea coast, the Kvijak River, then up to Lake Iliamna, across the Alaska Peninsula, and up Cook Inlet to Anchorage. Did it over a 5-month period from March to September 2013. Finished just 48 hours ago. We're pre-recording today's show so we could get Bob on our show before he heads back to Minnesota and back to his job building roads in Minnesota. An amazing journey all by yourself that is just extraordinary. And I hope you get a chance to write a book or something. You've got a great blog, which we're linking at alaskapublic.org, where people can learn some about it. But as you said, your communications were very poor, so a lot of what's on the blog is other people talking about you've called them and told them what's going on, or have you sent them a letter, or you've sent a chip with some pictures.
Correct.
Yeah. Did you keep a journal or something?
Yeah,
or?
I kept a daily journal. Yeah, uh-huh. That's the best way to keep track of the days.
Yeah, otherwise, like, what day is it, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, at some point you're going to want to turn, are you going to turn that into anything? Have you thought about a book or something like that?
I'm not sure. I really had no intentions of doing
that. That's not what it's all about.
No, it's not. But so many people are telling me I got to do something. So I who knows? Maybe something will come out of it. But
yeah,
I'm not planning it at this point.
So when we left off, you had arrived in Skagway, and it was a very, very snowy. And you're thinking about, okay, no, it's a 35-mile trip, very steep, over the Chilkoot Pass to get up to Lake Bennett and float your way down to the Yukon River. And you've got a canoe, a lot of food, a lot of other gear, and for those who tuned in late, this is not an inflatable canoe. This is a rigid, heavy canoe that you're going to carry over that same place where the Stampeders went over, and everybody's seen the pictures of how steep it is. What were the, you're in Skagway and it just looked too snowy to you, or what was the situation?
No, when I checked in at Skagway there, I had a package there of food waiting for me. So I picked up the food at a local business there that they actually do guided trips in the Chilicoot. So right away they warned me that things were really bad.
Avalanche conditions. You're
correct, yep. Snow and avalanche and cold. And I knew I had to check in with the National Park Service. You don't need a permit before June 1st, but they still want you to check in. So I tracked down somebody with the Park Service, and they looked at me with a funny look like, you can't do this. She did her best to talk me out of it, and I wasn't going to be talked out of it. And so she said, well, why don't you come back in a couple hours? I want you to meet the chief ranger here. Mm-hmm. I think it was their attempt, a second attempt to try to talk me out of it. But so I did meet with the chief ranger and her, and then once he realized he wasn't going to be able to turn me around, then they became really helpful, give me advice to do the trail as safe as I could. But he told me right away that if I went up there and something happened, don't expect help because they're not sending any rangers up for a while. Mm-hmm. So I was planning on departing in about 3 days after I reached there.
And you had never done any, like, wintertime mountaineering in Alaska. It's not like this was an old...
No, in Minnesota, it's mostly flat country. So I'm good with real cold weather, extremes, and snow. But no, I've never been up in the mountains in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. So this was a new thing for me.
Yeah. And yeah, all this gear you had to get, I mean, you'd have to do it multiple times. You wouldn't just carry everything at once.
Yeah, I was hoping, in the planning stages, I was hoping to do it in two trips. But when I weighed out my stuff, and even when I pared my stuff down for the porridge, I was still looking at least three trips to do it.
And how many pounds of stuff did you carry over the pass?
It was 250 pounds.
Wow.
Of gear.
Including the canoe?
Including the canoe, uh-huh. Yep. Because before I left Skagway, I got rid of any equipment that I didn't absolutely need. So I was giving away stuff in town and giving away my fishing rods and all that kind of stuff. And so I was getting ready to head out up on the trail, and I decided before I left I should go to church and just say a few things just to try to get a little help. So the night before I went up the trail, I went to church, and they seen I was a stranger, so they had me introduce myself. And so I said, what I'm going to be doing, I'm leaving tomorrow for the Chilicoot. And then after the service, I walked outside, and a local there came up to me and said, I was just up there with a snow machine at 6,000 feet. He said, I was looking down at the Chilicoot Pass. He said, it's the worst snow avalanche conditions he's seen in 40 years. And this guy was a very experienced snowmobiler up in the high country.
Well, and if people don't know, even during the gold rush, there was an avalanche up there that killed 45 people in one shot.
Yeah, that's correct. And then this guy's name was Doug. And he said, I haven't been to church since he married his wife. And he was about 65 years old, and he said, it must be fate that I saved your life today. He said, you don't want to go up there. So I thought about it, and thought, yeah, it must be fate. So I decided to wait another week, try to give it some time to mellow out. That was a hard week to sit by and wait, because I was in that adventure mode where I was a push, 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 and now I had to just sit there.
And you got some sunny weather, and it consolidated the snowpack a bit? Or
it made it worse. Realistically, because it was in the 60s, the sun came out, so the snow started getting real soft and heavy, which I guess makes it ripe for avalanche. It did melt some of the snow on the U.S. side, but there was still a real high danger. But I got tired of waiting; that I got to give it a try.
Wow. So what did you did you have snowshoes?
Snowshoes, and I had crampons.
Snowshoeing in that wet, decaying snow is horrible.
Yeah, the crampons ended up being more useful than the snowshoes because the snow was so wet and heavy that in most areas I didn't sink beyond my knees, but it was real slippery, heavy snow. So the crampons, the big cleats, I could dig in and keep my footing.
Yeah, you'll just slide right on top of the snow in the snowshoes. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So I'm worried for you're still alive. So I know that you made it. But so then you head on up and you've got to not only deal with these avalanche conditions, but deal with them four times as you ferry your stuff up.
Yeah, most of the route I was able to carry in three loads, except for what they call the golden staircase, which is the last 3/4 mile.
It's like 45 degrees.
Yeah, the steep part. Yeah, we see the classic picture of the Stampeders walking up. Mm-hmm. Yep, that piece, I decided I better do it in four trips.
And I just, picturing you carrying a canoe up there.
Yeah, and when I got there, the slopes were really unstable. There was there wasn't big snow slides, but there was, I call them slush slides, which I guess are fairly dangerous too, because they will break your,
pull your legs.
Sure. Yeah. So as I started going up that that final ascent, it looked really unstable. So I veered off toward the rock cliff. I got to the rock cliff edge, and I built a trail, steps up along that rock face, thinking if the slope went down, I'd be safer up against the rock than I would be out in the open snowpack.
Wow, that's really steep. That sounds pretty scary in itself.
Yeah, and I wasn't really sure how I was going to get the canoe up and over there. I didn't know if I could drag it that steep or carry it. So when I got there, I looked at the slope and I said, well, now it's time to decide how I'm going to do it. So I tried, I had 50 feet of rope with me. So I my first attempt was to walk 50 feet and then pull the canoe up, anchor it somehow, walk 50 feet. Well, that was really difficult and dangerous, because trying to anchor it on that steep slope was really hard to do.
When you're pulling the canoe, it could just pull you right down.
Yeah. So I tried a couple of different things, and I just finally said, I'm going to try to shoulder it and just go over top with it on my shoulders. And that turned out to be the most effective way.
Wow. So windy?
It was calm that day with the canoe.
You wouldn't have made it otherwise.
Not on my shoulders.
Yeah.
No. The previous day, doing the approach, it was windy. So that area that was about 30-degree slope, I had to drag the canoe there, and that wasn't easy either. So
you must have just been thinking, get over this thing. The quicker I'm over, the less time I'm in danger.
Oh, absolutely. Yep. Yeah. Yep. And they always say, you know, don't travel in the afternoon because that's when the danger increases. But it didn't really matter, because at night it was 50 degrees anyhow. So the snowpack never cooled down. It was always wet, dangerous. So it didn't matter when. So I just pushed as hard as I could to get over the top.
And were you doing the whole stretch with one load and then go back and do the whole thing, or were you doing shorter jumps?
Shorter jumps. They have, you know, camps every about 3 or 4 miles along the trail. So I was trying to get to that location, the next location every day. So it was three or four trips a day or to get to the next camp. So I was leapfrogging my gear. I wanted my stuff together every night if I could.
So that must have been a huge relief to get to the top of that thing.
It was. I got that one day. I got the canoe and my first load of pack up there, and then I got back down. I was so tired, I actually took the next day off. I didn't take very many rest days, but I was due a rest day.
So yeah, really?
I stayed overnight in sheep camp, and then the next day I took the other two loads up to the summit.
And it sounds like your luck kind of turned after that, because the ice started going out on the lake just in time.
Well, people say that once you get over the top, it'd be easy. It looks easy on a map.
Yeah.
It was just as hard to, to get from the summit to Lake Bennett as it was
the deep snow.
The deep snow, and there's ups and downs where you're climbing up a 500-foot hill and then back down again. Yeah, and so that was not easy either.
Did you ever just drag the canoe behind you on the snow?
When I came down off the summit, the canyon side was really deep snow conditions, big, huge snow drifts, probably 100 feet deep. I thought about sitting in the canoe and sliding down. It was tempting. It was so steep. So
zero control. God knows what would happen to you, right?
Yeah, I'm like, that might be too fast. So I put some ropes on the canoe, and I roped around the canoe on the bottom side to give it some friction. And I let it down in front of me as I went down the slope with it. And then I hit the first lake. There is called Crater Lake, and that was, of course, it was still frozen. But the snow was only an inch deep there, so I was actually able to put my gear in the canoe, like a sled, and put a heavy pack on to get some of the weight out of the canoe, and I was able to drag it for about 3 miles. That was a nice change of pace for carrying.
So did you start out with winter camping gear, or is it just because you're just camping in the snow every night, right?
Yeah, it was the same gear I had coming up the coast, so nothing special.
Yeah.
As it turned out, it was warm temperatures, but I was prepared for, you know, the worst. I knew it could be 20 below up there, too, so I was prepared to dig snow caves and light a candle and survive that way, too. So
yeah, amazing. Bob Volhaber is my guest. He's just completed a 5,000-mile canoe trip starting in Washington, going through the Chilkoot Pass and then down the Yukon River, more than an hour of material to talk about here. But you paddled across the Lake Bennett and the other lakes and went down the upper Yukon, which is pretty, the white water, that stopped many a gold rush or two. Was that challenging?
It was not. You know, the worst waterfall, or not waterfall, but rapid areas have been dammed since the gold rush days, which is around Whitehorse. So the most dangerous ones have been removed. So there's one serious rapids further down that I had to be careful with. You just got to know which channel to take, and I took the right channel. So
yeah, you're here.
I was told if you take the wrong channel, you might die. You take the right channel, you're in good shape.
So just get a little local knowledge, huh?
Yeah.
So where did you stop off in Whitehorse? And
I stopped off in Whitehorse, got some more resupplies.
There you go.
Yep.
And then down to Dawson City. And you and the ice was just going out sort of right ahead of you.
Yes, it was. I hit Lake Bennett 2 days before ice out, so it was pretty good timing.
Yeah.
And I then Marsh Lake, which is some people say is the beginning of the Yukon River. I was there a day and a half before ice out there, so I was I was really a good timing with the ice out.
Right. Yeah. So you got, I mean, as I was saying, you got a little bit lucky there in terms of you didn't have to. You didn't have to wait around like you did in Skagway.
Right, that's correct.
And then into the Yukon, that must the lower below Dawson City, the Yukon is pretty placid, and that must have been a bit of a relief.
Actually, it wasn't. I preferred the faster water upstream. Yeah, it's the from Whitehorse. It's going. There's a lot of it that goes 8, 9 miles per hour, maybe 10.
Make good time.
Yeah, if you look at my website, you'll see I was probably going 12 miles per hour a lot of time. And boy, you can cover some distance going that fast. So that was enjoyable. But yeah, further down you get into the Yukon Flats, which is a big area where the river is braided and it gets really wide, and it kind of gets boring.
Is it difficult to find your way through there?
You got to pay attention to your whatever you're using for a map. Yeah, definitely.
Because you could find your way off into some kind of a slough or a cutoff somewhere.
With real shallow water, then you're kind of stuck dealing with shallow water. Yes.
All right. So let's take you down the Yukon, and so that we don't run out of time. Stop me if there's some great adventures along the way. But then you get to where the Chandler meets the Yukon after 900 miles, probably paddling. I don't know. How long did that take you? A month or?
Oh, no. No, I'm thinking that's 10 days or something. I was going over 100 miles a day, I think.
Amazing.
Yeah, I haven't looked at it, but I think I was told 100 some miles a day.
That's amazing. Really, that's extraordinary. So how many hours a day would you canoe?
Between 10 and 12 hours, unless I got stuck out there. Sometimes the worst was 16 hours. That's too long.
Yeah, well. And your paddle, you're a fast paddler, and you got a current.
Yeah, I paddle with what's called the power racing stroke. So you're paddling real fast, short strokes. So it's 50 or 60 strokes per minute.
Wow.
It looks like you're really pushing hard, but it's actually the most efficient way to paddle.
Over 12 hours every single day.
Yeah.
Your muscles must have just turned into like.
The first 2 weeks was a little agony on my whole body, but yeah, you get through it and.
Yeah.
And first it's muscle pain, then it's joint pains. But you're in the canoe all day, so I had opportunities to try different things to get around the pain. And Yeah.
Okay, so going up 150 miles up the Chandler River, were you lining the canoe up quite a bit, or were you able to actually fight that current?
Well, I was almost ready to give up on that because in Fort Yukon, I talked to about a dozen or 15 locals, and they all said it was impossible. They said I was going to die. It was too dangerous, too swift. I even talked to a couple of women that lived in Veniti, which is on the Chandler. Veniti? Okay, yeah. But I thought I have to take a look at it and see for myself because I've gotten bad advice before. So I did go over to the Chandler. I looked at it. The piece where I hit was, the gradient was 5 feet per mile. So I thought, I looked at it, it looked like that's doable. So I started out and I was paddling probably 60% of the time I could paddle, 40% lining. But on the second day, it got steeper, and it ended up being a lot more lining than it was paddling. So I was doing about 10 miles a day lining the canoe, which is excruciatingly tough.
Yeah, pulling the canoe, and it's in the current, and it's always getting hung up on stuff.
Yeah, what I did for a technique is I'd pull it up the sandbar or the gravel bar, and until it ran out, you'd get a bend, and then you'd be on a cut bank. And that's where all your sweepers are at, the deep water and the fast current. So I'd go up the cut bank as far as I could, and then I'd cut across the river trying to hit the opposite bank where there's usually another sandbar.
Jump back in the canoe and cross.
Well, I'd always get pushed back down the river. Yeah. So it was a battle to go back and forth. So it was a constant, you know, get out of the canoe, line it, jump back in, paddle across, line it, And that technique seemed to work really good.
Just working your way up,
yeah.
10 miles a day of really hard work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like that was per hour.
That was the period where I think Fairbanks had a spell there of 90 degree days.
Uh-huh.
I think it was the same up there too, because it was really hot.
Oh, man. And that's hard work, just pulling the canoe, huh?
And the mosquitoes, that's where I got into the real thick clouds of mosquitoes. So I was dressed, you know, completely covered with gloves, long sleeve shirt, everything, so I didn't have to deal with.
Head net?
You know.
You wish you had one?
Well, I capsized on the Chandler on the fifth or sixth day.
Uh-huh.
And I lost my head net that day.
Oh, wow.
So I had a head net.
Talking to Bob Volhaber, who has completed this 5,000-mile journey through Alaska by canoe, the show is Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're pre-recording the show. Bob just got back 48 hours ago, just arrived in Anchorage, pulled up on the coastal trail in his canoe after this amazing journey. So, and we're running out of time, but you got up the Chandler and then basically until it was gone.
Yep, that's right, until it was a dry creek bed.
And then you carried your gear overland.
Yeah, across through it was heavy spruce bush until I got up in the high country. Then at the pass, it was open tundra, alpine tundra.
Uh-huh.
So I was pretty much just
going by
compass.
Topographic map and just hoping that there's a way through there?
Using my compass and trying to go straight line if I could. But I tried to stay up on the mountain slopes where it was a little better going, and then down in the drainages where you get real thick willow brush and soft ground. So that was how I was able to do it, was I stayed up in the high country.
And then you launched back into the Koyukuk.
Yeah, I got there in the evening, and I really wanted to get to my cabin. So instead of just camping for the night, I hopped in and headed down the Koyukuk River, heading for my cabin.
Mm-hmm.
I got there about 10 o'clock that night.
How long had it been since you'd been at the cabin?
24 years.
Wow.
And I was really curious to see what became of the cabin. Before I left it 24 years ago, I told some local moose hunters that, go ahead and use it as much as you want.
And we've got some pictures of it on the website. It looks like a cozy little sort of sod log cabin.
It worked out well. Yep, log cabin. I used the moss for chinking.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
So it was still habitable?
No, it was gone. It was burned to the ground.
Oh, really? Okay.
So it was kind of a slight low point.
A little bit of a disappointment there,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, I got there at 10 o'clock, almost at dark, and the mosquitoes were really bad there, but I knew that. I walked up to the site and like, oh, no, it's gone. Nothing left there, but my Biffy was still there, but the cabin was gone.
Uh-huh. So you just set up the tent and camped out.
Yeah, and I left early the next morning. It was no use sticking around.
Sure. And then floated down the Koyukuk until it rejoins the Yukon. Yeah. Was that a good float?
At this point, I was out of food, so I was getting really hungry. I had ran out of food up on when I was doing the portage to get to the Koyukuk.
Uh-huh.
So I was desperate for food. When I got down to the haul road, I pulled out for the day to try to buy some food from traveling public.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would sell me food. They all gave me some food, so it turned out really good.
So you sort of waving down cars?
I didn't have to. There was a couple people camped at the river crossing, and a couple people stopped over because his wife was getting sick. And so I was able to get food without having to jump out and stop traffic.
Oh, that's nice.
But yeah, I was out of food.
I bet they were pretty amazed to meet you, too.
Yeah.
Tell them what you're up to.
Yeah, I had a lot of that happen during the trip.
That's great. So then rejoin the Yukon and floating down and you're really wanting to get to the Bering Sea before the weather turns in the fall, right?
Right. I wanted to get there before September if I could.
Mm-hmm. And you by far made that.
Yeah,
right?
I did. Yep.
So getting down to the Yukon. I mean, you floated virtually the entire Yukon except for a small detour overland.
Right.
Crazy. Yeah. And so that must have been felt great to get to the end of the Yukon.
It did, yeah. I reached Emonic. I stopped in Emonic, tried to find a tide book, and I couldn't find a tide book. And so I just kept on going that night, and I got to the Bering Sea. And
stopping off little villages, telling people what you're up to, their jaws drop, and they give you advice. And
the further I went, the more that I got.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So you got down to the mouth of the Yukon, and nobody has ever probably canoed from the mouth of the Yukon to the mouth of the Kvitchak, I would guess.
That I know about. I couldn't find anybody, not even a kayaker. So.
And it sounded like one of your big hazards there, just looking at your blog, was the fact that these mudflats, and it's really difficult to land.
Yeah, there are extensive mudflats all the way from the mouth of the Yukon, 500 miles south to Quinnahock. That whole stretch is continuous mudflats. When the tide goes out, the mudflats extend out there a mile to 3 miles, and some of the bays, which are really big, you know, 8-9 miles across, completely are mudflats.
And if you run into weather in that situation, as anybody who boats in Alaska knows, you're stuck because you can't land on mudflats in bad weather.
Yeah, that's another piece of the journey. I didn't know how I was going to deal with it. You know, it's because I didn't want to be out there at low tide and be out there 2 miles from land and then have a blow come up.
Right.
I'd be stuck there. But I ended up doing that. I stayed out there during low tide and waited for a high tide to come back in. Or sometimes I was lucky and found a river where I could go up the river to get to the high ground.
Did you just get lucky with the weather? Or
what? No, I had terrible, terrible winds.
All right, so you are like now a canoeist who's just going to say, like, be in a Bering Sea storm and just like, okay, well, I'll just brave it.
The good thing is that shallow water continues. Even on the edge of the mudflats, it's shallow, slope way out. So the big waves were always breaking, you know, a long ways from where I was at. So I actually felt good about it after a while. I was afraid that the mudflats were going to drop off in the deep water.
I figured you'd be in breakers, but they're breaking, and so you're just in foam.
Yeah, foam and smaller ones. So it was actually comforting to be, you know, to know that it's all shallow, even though it was tough to paddle through in shallow water. But it was safer than I thought.
Because you get stuck.
Yeah, you need 2 feet of water to paddle, and if you're in 8 inches, it's really hard to paddle in that kind of condition. But it was safe when things got rough. I could go in shallow water and paddle that way.
And so just working your way down the coast, camping out on the beach at night and that kind of thing?
Yeah, and the worst thing is when I left the beach in the morning at high, or whenever I had a high tide, I never knew if I was going to be back on shore again in 8 hours, 12 hours, or 24. I never knew how I was going to get back to shore. It was really a lot of pressure knowing that I might not be able to make it to shore that night.
Right. And did you have that happen to you where you had to stay out overnight?
I had a few nights where I was out there till 2 in the morning.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
a couple times I got stuck on the mudflats. I got caught in the mudflats, and I couldn't get out in deeper water. So I got high and dry, and I just had to sit there and wait for the next tide to come back in.
So how long did that take you to go from the Yukon to the Kwajak?
I never even counted the days. It must have been. I got to the Kwajak, maybe a month ago.
So it was the month of August is when you're doing this.
Yeah, it must have been about a month.
Yeah.
It was a lot quicker than I thought. I allocated 50 days for that, and I did it, I think, in about 30 days.
How many miles is that?
It's 1,000 miles by hugging the coastline.
Wow.
But as I gained experience, I cut across a lot of bays, taking some risk.
Yeah.
So I probably cut it down to about 900 miles.
Jeez, that's amazing. All right, so then up the Kwajak, I don't know what that's like. Is that pretty fast water?
It is fairly fast, and it gets really fast up toward Iliamna. As I approached the Kwajak River, I was in Kwajak Bay, they call it, still about 4 miles wide, and I was going to follow the high tide, the flood tide up in the river.
Mm-hmm.
Things were going good at about 9 at night, and then a wind came from upriver against me. So now I had the tide versus the wind.
A big waves, yeah.
It was terrible. That was the worst conditions I had. There was standing waves about 4 feet tall, and I had to paddle into them. Otherwise, I was going to capsize. I just knew I was going to capsize because they were too steep. So that was really a difficult night.
At night?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, but I was stuck out there till about 10:30, and I was paddling by flashlight. So I could hear the bad waves coming.
Oh,
and I just had to make sure I kept the bow, because if I didn't keep the bow pointed at the waves, I knew I was going to capsize, and I knew there was no way I could get back in the canoe in that condition.
And then you're dead.
Yeah. That was the only time I think my theory of pretending I'm not scared didn't work, because I did have fear that night. Yeah,
I can imagine. I mean, you can't see. You can't even see.
I had a strong flashlight headlamp, but I could see probably about 100 feet.
Yeah. And so you're just basically holding. Are you making progress? Or you're just holding and trying to not capsize.
I was moving really fast. The current was pushing me.
Oh, I got you.
Pushing me 8 miles per hour against the river current, and the wind was coming about 25 miles per hour at me. So I just kept the ball pointed into the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to go about 4 miles to get to the shore.
Mm-hmm.
And it took about an hour and a half, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was relieved when I hit the shore that night.
Oh, I bet. So. In just a couple of minutes we have left, we still have so much more to talk about. You got up the river into Lake Iliamna. Now fall is coming. And yep. we know it's been a very rainy fall, so you were getting drenched.
I started getting drenched for a month before that, so yeah. I was used to being wet. I was wet yeah. for a month and a half ever yeah. since St. Mary's on the Yukon River, so I was used to that.
Paddled right up the Kwajalein into Lake Iliamna, and then, as you mentioned, 90 miles across the lake, and then down on the other side to Cook Inlet. It sounds like you had a pretty scary time in Cook Inlet getting back to Anchorage, too.
Yeah, there was a few heavy wind days out there too, and there's mud flats in Cook Inlet, as I'm sure everybody in Anchorage knows. So there was some long stretches, 10 miles long, where I had to stay out 2-3 miles out there. And one time I had a wind come up blowing me toward the mud flats, and these mud flats are different than the Bering Sea. When you get to the edge, they drop off deep, mm-hmm. so the surf zone is right where I'm canoeing.
Right.
So yeah, I had 4-foot waves. Break and well, they broke. They were probably 6 feet tall, and I got caught by one, spun me around and capsized me.
Where was this?
Oh, about 200 miles from Anchorage.
Just down on the west side of Cook Inlet.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it was about on the third day before coming here to Anchorage. And
really, so this we were talking about within the last week.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, so you flipped, and what did you do?
Quickly bailed the canoe out. And then I climbed back, and I practiced re-entry at home. So mm-hmm. I knew I could get back in the canoe if the waves would let me. So,
and this wasn't the first time you'd flipped on the trip?
No, it was the second. Yeah. This third time on the uh-huh. trip I'd flipped.
So you're in that extremely cold water, and you're just wearing regular clothes, right?
No, I had a dry suit on.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Unfortunately, my neck gasket was ripped, so I still had some water coming down my neck.
Mm-hmm.
So I climbed back in the canoe, and it was still had some water, and my load was shifted, so I was kind of canoeing off center.
Uh-huh.
About an hour later, I capsized again. And this time, I couldn't get out of the canoe. The spray skirt had me locked in there, and I couldn't get free. So I was upside down for, I don't know, 15, 20 seconds.
Wow.
A couple times, I was able to come up for air. But that was a little difficult and dicey to get out of the canoe.
That might have been one of your closest calls.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got out, bailed it out, and bailed repeat out the and procedure?
Got back in, and I kept on going. I thought, I'm not going to let this beat me. I'm going to keep going. So
yeah.
I went for another.
Can't come 5,000 miles and give up. Yeah.
So, yeah, I made it to shore that night. And yeah.
Yeah, amazing story. So he made it, and that was right at the end.
Third to last day, yep.
Yeah, and folks, if you want to know more, you're going to have to look at Bob's blog, which we have on our website, alaskapublic.org. Bob Volhaber has completed this incredible 5,000-mile canoe journey, starting in Washington, going through the heart of Alaska and making it to Anchorage 48 hours ago. I'm honored to have met you and gotten to talk about this, and I do hope you do at some point do a more complete version of it, because it's a great story. And I like the quote that you have on your blog, persistence and determination alone are omnipotent.
That's what did it.
That's your story.
Yes,
that's
it
your
is.
Story. Well, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That interview was recorded on September 17th. On next week's Outdoor Explorer, October 31st, Halloween, we'll be talking about the first snow, whether it has arrived or not. This is the season when we're all looking at the winter weather, waiting for it to happen. We'll learn the factors that control winter in South Central Alaska. That's all for today. Thanks for joining us. Our producer and audio engineer was Kristen Platt. I'm Charles Woolforth. We'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.